oversized mirror of the man standing next to her, and similarly vacant of expression. The emptiness to the woman's gaze told of a failure to fully perceive the world, as if she were drugged. As the door swung closed, Lizanne caught sight of a man's body lying face down next to the workbench, a recent and broad patch of blood spreading across the tiled floor.
"Father tried to stop her," Tinkerer explained. "She stabbed him in the chest with a screwdriver."
She and Tinkerer followed the woman on a southward trek through winding streets and alleys. She moved with an automatic precision, turning this way and that without pause, as if locked into a preset course. Eventually, she emerged from a narrow walkway onto the broad wharf of the Valazin dockside. She sidestepped the many carts and barrows with unconscious ease, making for a large three-story building Lizanne recognized as the port's custom house. Tinkerer's mother walked up to the uniformed guard on the door and presented the box, Lizanne catching her soft, precise tones as she said,
"I was told to give you this."
The guard's face broke into a puzzled smile as he bent to accept the box. The expression abruptly turned to consternation when the woman turned on her heel and walked briskly away. The guard had time for a half-shouted command to stop before the box exploded. Lizanne was impressed by the woman's skills, somehow managing to cram so powerful a device into such a small container. When the smoke cleared, there was little left of the guard save a red smear surrounding the ruined custom house door. Tinkerer's mother stood a short distance from the carnage, hands folded over her fulsome belly and an oddly satisfied smile on her lips. When a squad of constables descended on her a few moments later, she said,
"Free Valazin! Death to the Empire!"
with all the conviction of a child reciting a poorly remembered rhyme.
"Why?"
Lizanne asked, as the memory faded into a grey mist.
She hardly seemed the radical type. "She was told to,"
Tinkerer answered, as the surrounding mist formed into a more familiar scene.
"Skorazin,"
Lizanne thought in sour recognition. This vision possessed the same clarity as the first memory, made all the more disconcerting by being an unwelcome reminder of her time within these walls. They looked out on the prison city through a part-shattered window, more rooftops than she remembered, just visible through the familiar haze of smoke fumes. Tinkerer had managed to perfectly capture the signature scent of sulfur, coal, and death she had hoped would never again assail her nostrils. She turned at the sound of a small plaintive cry behind her, seeing a man cradling an infant beside the bleach-faced body of a woman covered by a filthy blanket. Stepping closer, Lizanne confirmed her suspicion that it was Tinkerer's mother, face even emptier now, having been slackened by death.
"They sent her here,"
Tinkerer said, moving to stand by the man with the infant.
"As he knew they would. Even a pregnant woman can expect no mercy if the crime is treason."
Lizanne looked closer at the crouching man, seeing a stocky, bald-headed fellow in his 30s, his face possessed of the sallow hardness that marked those who spend years within the walls. He stared down at the child in his arms with what appeared to Lizanne to be cold animosity, his face betraying not the slightest twitch as the baby raised a tiny hand to his unshaven cheek.
"Who is he?"
she asked.
"You met him once before," Tinkerer said. "But he was dead by then."
Lizanne recalled the chamber beneath Tinkerer's quarters in the cinnabar mine, the 14 corpses that had included the long-dead artisan.
"He brought you here,"
she realized, her mind stumbling over the implications with unaccustomed confusion.
"How?" "The trance,"
Tinkerer replied. He stepped back as the man got to his feet, moving with the infant to the window. Lizanne frowned in consternation, this all being so far outside her experience. How could a man compel a non-blessed soul to such extreme action via the trance?
She remembered what Clay shared with her about Silverpin's revelation when they discovered the White's lair, about there being more to the trance than just shared memory.
Blue is a remarkable product. Your kind understands only the barest fraction of its power.
Somehow the blade hand had compelled the rest of the long rifles to keep searching for the White, long after it became obvious the most rational course would be to return to Carvenport. Also, she had been able to bind Clay somehow, forcing him to confront the sleeping White. But they had both been blood-blessed, whereas Tinkerer's mother couldn't have been.
He had the blessing,
Lizanne said, nodding to the man who now stood cradling the infant as he stared out at the prison city.
As do you, but your mother didn't. The blessing is not hereditary. What is the mind if not a means of controlling the body?
Tinkerer said.
To share a mind is to share control, or surrender it to a greater will. He had been searching for me for a long time, or one like me, sending his mind out far and wide until he snared a blood-blessed infant still nestling in its mother's womb. The mind of an unborn child is blank, easily claimed, and through it, so is the mother. Later, he saw fit to share the memory of the act that had brought her here, the crime he had forced her to commit. I believe he hoped it would distress me. Instead, I found it fascinating.
The man at the window spoke then, his voice low and croaking, the rasp of a guilty soul.
You poor little fucker, he said as the child squirmed in his arms. If I was any kind of a man, I'd strangle you right now.
The memory shifted again, swirling into another darker space.
His home in the mine,
Lizanne realized, looking around at the rough-hewn rock. Tinkerer was at least 10 years old by now, though his slightness of frame may have made him seem younger. He sat on a stool next to a bed, holding a cup of water to the lips of a barely conscious older girl. Though apparently in her mid-teens, the girl was so tall, her bare, soot-covered feet protruded off the edge of the bed.
Can't stay,
a raspy voice said, and Lizanne turned to see the man from the previous memory, standing unsteadily in the chamber entrance. His countenance had become even more sallow and sunken in the intervening years, and his eyes were dark reddish holes in his face. A half-empty bottle dangled from his hand, and Lizanne could smell the acrid stain of whatever concoction it contained on the man's breath.
Can't have her here,
the man went on, voice loud and slurred as he waved the bottle about.
Shouldn't have brought her.
The young tinkerer barely glanced at the man, continuing to hold the cup to the girl's lips, and speaking in a flat voice he would carry into adulthood.
I expected you to have expired by morning. Your organs must be close to failing by now.
The man responded with a snarl, which sounded somewhat half-hearted to Lizanne, as if he had long exhausted all anger for the boy he had condemned to this place.
Always the fucking same, he growled. Ever since you were old enough to speak.
There's no soul in you, boy.
He took a long drink from the bottle, his throat working with greedy, desperate gulps that told Lizanne this was a man engaged in a protracted suicide attempt.
We'll sell her to that bitch who took over the miner's repose,
he added upon draining the bottle.
Once she's healed up and all.
No,
Tinkerer said, setting the cup aside.
You will be dead soon, and I require assistance.
The girl on the bed groaned and shifted a little, Lizanne noting the marks of a recent and severe beating on her face. Despite the discoloration and the swelling, it was still possible to recognize Melina's high cheekbones and strong nose, although at this point she evidently retained possession of both eyes. Lizanne had liked her, as much as it had been possible to like any inmate of Skorazin. Melina, although brutalized by her years within the walls, but at least possessed a straightforward fairness and lack of duplicity that set her apart. Lizanne found she couldn't suppress a twinge of guilt at the woman's eventual fate, shot in the head during the first chaotic charge into the wreckage of the Citadel, itself a spectacular distraction Lizanne had orchestrated to facilitate her own escape.
"Your regret is misplaced,"
the older tinkerer told her.
"She would certainly have killed you had she survived. Forgiveness was not a trait she possessed."
"As interesting as this all is," Lizanne replied, "you have yet to show me what became of the artisan."
"He became him."
Tinkerer nodded at the sallow-faced drunkard, now glowering at the boy in impotent rage.
"In time, so did I."
Another shift in the vision, the setting switching to a much darker place. The young tinkerer had sprouted several inches in height in the interval. He crouched at the drunkard's side, holding up his ingenious lantern so the focused beam could fully illuminate the man's face. The drunkard had lost much of his body weight by now, his features gaunt and skin resembling old yellowed paper in the lamplight. It was clear to Lizanne he had only a small amount of life left to him. His eyes were half closed, and his lips moved in a faint murmur. The young tinkerer leaned closer to catch the sibilant rasp.
"You're the last. You know that?"
"The last of what?"
the youth inquired, a rare frown of puzzlement on his brow.
"Ease."
The dying man's hands jerked, and Tinkerer turned the lamp to illuminate the bodies. 13 in all, and soon to be joined by one more.
"All of these lived wretched lives trapped in this place, just to bring you here."
He managed to lift a shaking hand and extend a finger, Tinkerer's lamp following it to reveal the oldest corpse, the one chained to the wall.
"That one began it all. Fucker!"
The man coughed out the insult and began to jerk spasmodically, breath catching.
"Started it. Called the first one. Found her in the womb. Just like I found you."
Tinkerer turned the lamplight back on the dying man, head angled in curiosity.
"Why?"
The man fumbled for something in the pocket of his besmirched clothes, coming out with a small glass vial.
"It's time,"
he rasped, holding the vial out to Tinkerer.
"She'll be coming. Soon need to be ready."
Tinkerer took the vial, Lizanne recognizing the hue as he played the lamplight over it. Blue.
"Ready for what?"
Tinkerer inquired, his voice betraying only mild interest, which Lizanne suspected concealed a raging curiosity. The man grunted out a wheezing laugh, baring half-rotted teeth in what was probably his first smile in decades.
"Escape, you little shit. What else?"
He held out the vial.
"Drink."
Lizanne watched Tinkerer take the vial and lift it to his lips, then hand it back to the dying man.
"If you do happen to find the artisan's ghost one day,"
he said, tipping the remaining blue down his throat,
"give them my undying hate."
He leaned forward then, grunting with the effort, staring into Tinkerer's eyes. The trance shifted again, the chamber fading into a black void, absent of light or sensation. Lizanne had experienced shallow minds before, mostly lacking in thought or imagination, but nothing as completely empty as this. She searched for Tinkerer but found nothing. Somehow he had been removed from a memory in his trance. Then she saw something in the dark, a small bright glimmer in the void. It grew as she went to it, and she saw it to be a metal box spinning in the darkness, a box of gears and cogs that caught the non-existent light as it spun and spun. A box she had seen before. The Solagraph Come Music box that had once belonged to Takeda's father. The work of the artisan's very own hand that had set her and Clay on this path. The mystery they had spent many hours trying to unlock in Jemiah's workshop. The trance vanished. Lizanne found herself blinking into Tinkerer's blank gaze. For a long moment, neither of them said anything.
Well?
Lizanne demanded as the silence stretched.
That is all I can give you. For your sake, I hope that is a lie. I showed you all that I can. There has to be more. There is, but it is behind a lock I cannot undo. But now you know the key.
The Solagraph, she thought. The Solagraph is the key. Everything always comes back to that damned box.
You know how it works,
she said, jaw clenched as she bit down on her frustration.
No, but if you want the memories in my head, you will have to find it and make it work.
Lizanne swallowed a hard, bitter laugh.
All those tales you had to tell me, she said, of his days in Aradzia, his many discoveries, of the women he loved and the men he hated. You don't actually know any of it, do you? No more than educated guesses.
He angled his head, frowning in marginal confusion.
I would have thought someone in your profession would appreciate creative dishonesty when demanded by necessity. You were always my only means of escape.
She turned away from him, clenching her fists to stop herself reaching for her revolver.
You were expecting me,
she realized, after taking a series of calming breaths.
That man, he said, she'll be coming soon. He was referring to me, wasn't he? I expect so. I believe it was a vision shared with him by his predecessor, but not one he chose to share with me. Out of spite, I suspect.
Tinkerer paused, raising his gaze to the cabin roof, as a loud pealing cry sounded throughout the ship.
What is that?
He inquired.
The ship's siren,
Lizanne said, refusing to be distracted.
How could he possibly have known I would be there?
Tinkerer's eyes narrowed slightly, in a gesture she had come to recognize as bemusement at the stupidity of others.
A question I pondered briefly until the answer became obvious, once all other possibilities had been discounted.
Lizanne winced as the ship's siren came again. Three long blasts.
He didn't know, she thought, striving to concentrate. The artisan knew, centuries ago. The future, she said, as the answer came to her in a rush. He saw the future. Yes, though quite how, I do not know. I suspect the answer is locked away with the other memories.
But she already knew the answer.
White blood.
Lizanne experienced a small moment of inner triumph, stirred by at least knowing one thing he didn't. The artisan must have drunk white blood.
That sounds urgent,
Tinkerer said, as the siren sounded again.
Stay here,
she said, rising from the bunk and moving to the door.
What does it mean?
He inquired. She paused to glance back at him, wondering if it might be better to get him to a lifeboat whilst there was still time. But she knew it to be a desperate notion. They would scarcely be any safer adrift on the high seas than on a protectorate battleship.
Enemy in sight, she replied. If the guns start up, lie down on the deck. If the White's forces seize the ship, I advise you to find the most efficient means of killing yourself.
With that, she hauled the door closed, and started off along the passageway at a run, making for the bridge. Chapter 3 Cirrus.
Slaves we may be, monsters we may be, but if we can be merciful, can we not love too?
Catria's words drifted through his head like the whisper of a morning breeze, kept deliberately faint by the fear he used to cloud the image of her death whenever it arose. But still, it was hard not to dwell on the sight of her scaled, despoiled features, so vibrant at the end, glowing with triumph during that last instant before his bullet tore through her head.
We can be merciful.
The words felt like the distant echo of a bad joke, as he surveyed the city below, the view being preferable to the spectacle unfolding behind him on the rooftop. He could see neat columns of spoiled moving through the streets towards their billets in the dockside warehouses. Smaller parties were engaged in a methodical search of every house, workshop, shed and sewer, for any feral citizens who had survived the assault and so far escaped capture. Many of those doing the searching had been citizens themselves only days before, and Cirrus wondered how many sons or daughters had been dragged from their hiding places to find themselves staring into the distorted visages of their parents. He stood atop the imposing fortress-like tower that had been, until very recently, the headquarters of the entire Ironship Syndicate. The White had chosen to nest on the building's broad, flat roof, along with its clutch of adolescent kin. Also present was the blood-blessed Mandalorian woman who had inexplicably arrived on a passenger liner the day after their seizure of Pharos. So far, she was the only one of her kind not to face near immediate slaughter upon entering the White's company. Instead, she had received instant elevation to the pinnacle of this monstrous army, something that Cirrus found piqued his pride in no small measure, much to his self-disgust. Moradin had been quick with his taunts, sensing Cirrus's resentment with grating ease.
General no longer, eh? Victory, it seems, brings no reward in the Legion of Flame.
For such a self-interested soul, the former Grand Marshal had a remarkable facility for divining the feelings of others. Cirrus's mind churned with questions regarding this woman. Who is she? Why does the White dote on her as if she were one of its own? Why didn't it kill her like the others? But the biggest mystery of all was the fact that the woman's mind remained her own, unshared and impenetrable. However, this didn't prevent her from invading the minds of other spoiled.
What are you looking at?
He turned to find her standing at his side, head angled in faint curiosity. The torn and scorched dress that had barely covered her when she first arrived in Pharos had since been exchanged for a formal attire of dark blue, the kind usually worn by women of the corporate managerial class. Adorning the otherwise plain jacket were four silver shareholder pins, each one taken from the corpse of an Ironship board member.
With one more to come,
Cirrus thought, resisting the impulse to look over his shoulder as another scream sounded.
The search is proceeding well,
he said aloud in Mandalorian, choosing to maintain his custom of speaking rather than thinking. He was curious to see if she objected to spoken communication. Besides, with this one there was no obvious indication she had absorbed any thought he might share. He sent a subtle probe her way as she followed his gaze, hoping to detect some faint leakage of emotion. But, as usual, there was nothing. Trying to touch her mind was like jabbing at a wall fashioned from cold, unyielding iron. He wondered if his inability to reach her thoughts was somehow related to the fact that she was only partially spoiled. Instead of the spines and discolored scales of his fellow slaves, a brief exposure to the blue crystal's light had left her with a mostly human appearance. A cluster of scales had appeared around her eyes, and a series of barely perceptible bumps marred the otherwise smooth perfection of her forehead. The eyes themselves showed the most change, and were another unique and mysterious facet of her story. Instead of the yellow eyes with which they had all been afflicted, hers were like two red coals set into black orbs.
"He let me choose,"
she said, surprising him by speaking aloud.
"I always liked the combination of red and black. It used to drive my dressmaker to distraction."
He blinked as her unnatural gaze lingered on him, his surprise heightened by the fact that she had spoken in Eutherian.
"Such a lovely tongue," she went on. "So much more elegant than Mandanorian, don't you find?"
Her tone and flawless accent put him in mind of the casual and meaningless chatter of the Corventine noble class. This was the kind of exchange he used to stammer his way through whenever his father had forced him to attend a social gathering. Somehow he knew that this woman would have felt entirely comfortable in such company. "In some ways," he replied, also in Eutherian. "Though it remains overly archaic in many instances, and the strictness of its grammar resists adaptation to the modern world."
"Spoken like a true technocrat."
She inclined her head, revealing slightly elongated eye teeth with a smile.
"And it's Kathleen, by the way,"
she added, with a shallow curtsy.
"Since you were wondering, Kathleen Dewsmine of the Sonora Dewsmines. At your service, sir."
"Cirrus Akiv Kapazin, miss," he replied with a bow. "Former curator of native artifacts at the Mooresvale Imperial Museum of Antiquities."
"Once a curator, now a general."
She pursed her lips in apparent admiration.
"You've risen high for one so young."
"I thought you were the general now." She surprised him again by laughing. She had a rich laugh he knew other men had assuredly once described as delightful.
"Oh, I wouldn't dream of stealing your honors, good sir. Not when you've done such sterling work in our wondrous cause. Your stratagems are so much more elegant and effective than that Corventine brute. Where is he, by the way?"
"Mopping up operations," Cirrus said. "Some survivors are lingering amongst the inland hill country, most of them refugees from Carvenport."
"Carvenport, eh? Will we find our elusive quarry amongst them, do you think?"
There was a sardonic twist to her lips that told him she already knew the answer. "I very much doubt it, miss."
"Kathleen, please."
She stepped closer, looping an arm through his and steering him away from the edge of the roof.
"And I will call you General, since you seem so attached to the term."
"Cirrus will suffice."
"Nonsense."
She tweaked his nose with a finger.
"I think we should accommodate some customs from the old world, don't you?"
She turned her focus on the ghastly tableau before them, smile broadening.
"Since so much of it is about to vanish forever."
The spread-eagled body of Madame Glorina Dolspeak, chairperson of the Ironship Board of Directors, was suspended in midair by virtue of each of her limbs being clutched firmly in the jaws of an adolescent wight. Her silver-gray head lolled as she voiced an exhausted scream that was more of a high-pitched gasp. A surprisingly small amount of blood leaked from the jaws of the wights, the youthful beasts having been careful not to inflict fatal damage as yet. It would have been a simple matter to convert the woman and pluck the secrets from her head, but it seemed Kathleen had a preference for complication, at least insofar as the Ironship Board were concerned.
"Pardon the interruption, madam,"
Kathleen apologized, switching smoothly to Mandanorian.
"Please do go on. You were telling us all about the fascinating Miss Lethbridge and her recent mission to the Corventine Empire. A perilous endeavor, to be sure, and all to decipher the workings of an old music box."
Madame Dolspeak gave no immediate response, continuing to sag in apparent exhaustion until the juvenile wights tugged in unison, the woman's slight form convulsing and a fresh yelp erupting from her lips.
"Yes,"
she grated through clenched teeth.
"The box! The artisan's box!"
A low, inquisitive rumble sounded above, and Cirrus raised his gaze to see the white lowering its massive head. Prior to this, the beast had regarded the interrogation with apparent indifference, but mention of the artisan seemed to have piqued its interest.
"Quite so," Kathleen said. "And what exactly is in this box, pray tell?"
"Answers,"
Madame Dolspeak whimpered, her body seeming to thrum with pain.
"A key to..."
Her gaze took on a sudden animation, eyes flashing at the huge drake looming above her.
"Defeating this monstrosity!"
She shouted the final word, pain-racked features molded into a mask of defiant hate. Cirrus couldn't suppress a pang of admiration at this, something which drew a sharp glance from Kathleen.
"You find something noble in this wretch, General?"
she inquired, her arm tensing against his. Although she was not fully spoiled, he could feel the strength in her, and added to that was the worrisome awareness that she was also a blood-blessed.
"Allow me to assure you, this woman is not worthy of your regard,"
Kathleen went on, fixing her gaze on the unfortunate ironship luminary. Cirrus could see the naked hatred shining in Kathleen's red-black eyes, her lips taking on a wet sheen as she continued.
"This woman and her kind have enslaved those like me for generations. But for my family's influence, they would have had me labor in their service like some slum-born slattern. Once, my family would have been great and powerful, standing high in the court of the Mandalorian Empire. Now, for all their wealth, they are beggars, grubbing for crumbs from the corporate table like every other slave in this world of greed, a world they created. It is they who are the true monsters. They who have raped an entire continent in their avarice and would have raped the whole world."
She unhooked her arm from Cirrus's and moved to crouch at Madame Dolspeak's side, leaning close to murmur in her ear.
"Tell me, madam, what were you going to do when all the product ran out? When you had wrung the last drop of blood from the last withered drake? What were you going to do then?"
Madame Dolspeak met Kathleen's gaze, matching the enmity she saw in full measure.
"I remember you,"
she said in a thin whisper.
"A spoiled little bitch, born to a family of wastrels. You'd spread your legs for the merest chance at a gossip column headline."
Somehow the woman managed to laugh, though it emerged from her throat as more of a choking sob.
"At least now your looks match your character."
Kathleen's lips drew back in a snarl, nails extending into claws as she clamped a hand to Madame Dolspeak's throat. A short grunt came from the white, and Kathleen froze, the snarl fading as she jerked her hand away as if it had been burned. Watching her retreat a few steps and take a calming breath, Cirrus was compelled to wonder at the viciousness of a woman who had to be restrained by one such as the white. After a moment, Kathleen straightened, smoothing her hands over her skirt, before staring down at the older woman with cold determination.
"The artisan's box," she said. "Where is it?"
For a moment, Madame Dolspeak said nothing, but soon began speaking in a rapid babble as the juvenile whites tightened their grip.
"Reported lost at Carvenport, though Blurskin was certain Lethbridge had placed it in her father's hands. He chose to leave it there in the hope the man could unlock it, then seize it when he had."
"Ah, yes, Thaddeus Blurskin," Kathleen said. "The esteemed director of exceptional initiatives, who had the good sense to blow his brains out when the city fell."
She paused for a moment, frowning in recollection.
"Lethbridge's father. Presumably that would be the famous Professor Grayson Lethbridge, genius inventor and denizen of this very port."
She turned a questioning glance in Cirrus's direction. "He's not amongst the captives or the new recruits," he reported promptly, hoping a steady current of fear would mask the memories provoked by the name Lethbridge. Decayla slaughtering the Greens with that infernal repeating gun, the balloon taking her away. As ever, the daughter of the late Burgrave Artonin retained an effortless capacity to haunt his thoughts. His disastrous wooing in Morsvale, the sight of her adorned with the ancient sapphire necklace, twirling in delight in the museum vaults, probably the only time he had managed to make her laugh. Then the moment only 3 nights ago when he stood naked in her sights.
"Out of bullets," she had said with a shrug. "I'll have his home searched," Cirrus added, flooding his mind with all the horrors he could muster, before turning his attention to the collective memory of the spoiled.
He was careful to scour the collective minds of the recent captives for the address, before issuing a thought command to a troop of spoiled. It wouldn't do for Catherine to question why he already knew of the location. The search party shared their findings as they tore through the domicile of Professor Lethbridge, finding no sign of the man or the elusive musical box. Also, no sign of Catria's body, which Cirrus had buried in the port's largest park. He put her close to the flower beds, thinking she might have liked that.
"Gather every scrap of paper and machinery," Catherine ordered. "Examine them yourself, General. I think this is a task for our keenest mind."
She paused as one of the searchers cast their gaze at the workshop ceiling, finding it mostly absent.
"No fire damage," she observed. "Why would the professor remove his own ceiling, I wonder?"
Cirrus was aware of her close scrutiny as he sorted through the melange of images captured by the collective mind of the army the night of Feros's fall. He had hoped the escape of Takela and her companions might have been missed altogether. Unfortunately, it transpired that several sets of eyes had glimpsed the balloon craft as it soared over the rooftops towards the northern shore of the island. All of those who had seen it had died in the fighting, but not before their memories had been shared with others. The vision was dull and misty, as was often the case with memories formed during combat, but clear enough to make out the dimensions of the novel conveyance and its 3 occupants.
"A dirigible aerostat," Cirrus said,
speaking aloud once more.
"I've read of experiments with such craft in northern Mandanor, but all were said to be at a very early stage." "Then the professor must be a man of even greater talent than his reputation allows,"
Catherine replied. She looked up at the white who gave a throaty rumble, before turning its massive head in the direction of a neighboring building. A dozen reds immediately rose from their perch atop the building's roof, Cirrus recognizing Katarius amongst them. The huge red took the lead as they adopted a northern course, wings sweeping in rapid arcs.
"Ingenious as it is," Catherine said, "it didn't strike me as the fastest of vehicles. We'll have them soon enough. Now then," she added briskly,
clasping her hands together and returning her attention to Madame Dolspeak.
"Let us discuss the strength of the Protectorate Northern Fleet."
Katarius returned 2 days later, appearing on the northern horizon as the sun began to fade. The red's wings moved in sluggish half-sweeps that barely caught the cooling evening air. He glided over the harbor wall to land on the quayside, head slumped and eyes dimmed with exhaustion. Catherine ordered he be fed immediately, and a trio of captives were duly dragged forward to be feasted upon. They were all in their early teens, too young to be worth converting, but kept alive for the amusement or nourishment of the drakes. Madame Dolspeak had at least been spared such a fate, though Cirrus doubted she saw much mercy in Catherine's decision to cast her broken but still living body from the headquarters rooftop.
"I would have you join us, dried-up old hag though you are," Catherine told the chairperson,
lifting the woman's spindly form above her head with effortless strength.
"Your experience and insight might have been useful, but I find that I simply can't stomach the thought of your mind touching mine. Any wisdom or defiance to share at the final moment?"
Madame Dolspeak raised her head, a stream of blood falling from her mouth as she tried to speak. The words were too soft to hear, and Cirrus doubted the woman was still capable of forming a rational thought in any case.
"Oh, never mind," Kathleen said, casting the chairperson away.
She stood watching her plummet to the ground, arms crossed and expression reflective rather than triumphant.
"I doubt it would have been one for the historians anyway. The other Reds died,"
she explained to Cirrus now, seemingly deaf to the screams and breaking bones behind her.
"Flew until they couldn't fly any longer, then fell into the sea."
There was a curiously mournful tone to her voice, as if she were speaking of cherished comrades lost in a noble cause.
"Thankfully, he alone managed to stay aloft and caught sight of this."
She pushed a memory into Cirrus's head, a small bulbous speck on a far horizon.
"It appears the winds carried them west. He followed for over an hour, but was forced to turn back lest he share his brother's fate. It was long enough to discern that the professor's marvelous contraption is losing height."
"Then the sea will claim them," Cirrus said, concealing a wince as Katarius tore the last of the captives in two with a loud snap of his jaws.
"The problem would appear to be solved." "We have to be sure," she replied, shaking her head. "The box must be destroyed, along with any who might unlock it. All other considerations are secondary."
She turned to survey the ships within the harbor walls. Their appearance was decidedly unimpressive, each one blackened by fire or scarred by explosions. Of the Protectorate warships at anchor in Pharos at the time of its seizure, only six could be said to be fully operational. The rest were undergoing extensive repairs, and those beyond saving were being cannibalized for weapons and parts. Cirrus estimated the full strength of the White's fleet would be some 25 vessels once the work was complete. Added to that were another 24 merchant vessels and blue hunters, which would be used as troop transports once their next destination had been made clear.
"I so wish to sail north, General," Kathleen said with a wistful air. "How I long to see Mandanore burn. But sadly, we have more pressing matters. It's time for you to add the title of Admiral to your collection."
Chapter 4. Hylemore.
"Who is she?"
"Told you who she is, Captain."
Clay gave Hylemore one of his signature punch-inviting grins. Hylemore wasn't sure whether to take some comfort from the fact that this young man had retained an effortless ability to annoy him, despite his recent travails.
"Her name doesn't tell me a great deal," he replied, striving to control his burgeoning ire. "And given our circumstances, I find my patience in short supply. So, I will ask you again."
He put both fists on the desk and leaned closer to Clay, meeting his gaze with unmistakable intent.
"Who is she?"
They were in the captain's cabin aboard the Dreadfire. Clay nursing a cup of something hot Lieutenant Steelfine had managed to concoct in the galley. Lieutenant Sigarol was being tended to by the youngest Torkreek, though Loriabeth herself seemed close to collapse from exposure. Despite that, she continued to nurse the Corventine Marine, and proved deaf to her father's stern and repeated order to rest. Then there was the woman named Kriz, who had not been a member of their party when they entered the spire, and yet had now somehow been retrieved from the depths. She had nodded a greeting when Clay introduced her, but seemed reluctant to utter more than a few words, her Mandanorian spoken in an uncannily perfect Carvenport accent. She sounded like someone raised in the Blinds, the notorious slum where Clay had spent his childhood years, but Hylemore knew instinctively that couldn't be the case. He felt an overriding sense of strangeness when he looked at her. Judging by her coloring, he would have taken her for a South Mandanorian, but there was an angularity to her features that made him doubt it. Added to that was her manner,
the way she stared at every fixture on the ship, eyes wary but also hungry for detail. Then there was the hour or more she had spent on deck, staring at the sky and the surrounding ice floes, her face occasionally breaking into a smile of unalloyed joy. The smile disappeared, however, the instant Heilmor attempted to talk to her, at which point she pulled her blanket tight about her shoulders and disappeared below decks. Heilmor couldn't help the feeling that, although he had witnessed something unbelievable in Clay's taming of Last Look Jack, this woman represented something far more incredible. "Her full name is Krizal," Clay said, hesitating before gulping down some of Steelfine's beverage and continuing in a tone of forced matter-of-factness. "Last survivor of the Phelos caste. She's about 10,000 years old and was the first bloodblessed born on this planet." He sipped from the mug again, smacking his lips in appreciation. "This is really good, whatever it is." The humor faded from his face as he glanced up at Heilmor's silent, glowering visage. "All right," Clay said with a sigh, setting the mug down on the desk. "But you better take a seat, Captain. This is a long story." "It's true," Lauriabeth said. "Every word of it." She jerked her head at Sigurol's slumbering form on the bunk behind her. "You can ask him when he wakes." She had curtained off a section of the hold to use as a sick bay, and hadn't strayed from the lieutenant's side since. Sigurd had been dosed with a small amount of their remaining stock of green, Lauriabeth also applying a diluted tincture of the product to his wound with a compress. Judging by the state of the damage, Heilmor entertained serious doubts the Marine would ever recover his sight in that eye. The pain had clearly left a deep mark, for the man fidgeted in his sleep, hands jerking repeatedly as if he were clutching his carbine. "An entire enclosed world down below." Heilmor shook his head in a mixture of awe and incredulity. "It's a hard tale to swallow, miss, not one the board will easily believe."
"They can believe what they like."
She gave a pointed glance at where Chris sat conversing with Clay at the galley table.
"Besides, it ain't like we got no proof."
Heilmor nodded his thanks and moved away, pausing to regard the ancient woman who appeared only a few years his junior. She and Clay spoke in a language Heilmor didn't know, an oddly inflected tongue of elongated vowels and soft consonants. "The language of the past," he assumed, "learned by Torkreek in the trance, along with many secrets he no doubt chose to keep back." Lengthy as the young blood-blessed story had been, Heilmor's experienced eye picked out several instances of slight hesitation, accompanied by the fractional aversion of the eyes that told of a lie or deliberate omission. "It won't do," he decided, starting forward with a purposeful stride. "I must know all of it to decide our course." His purpose, however, was soon interrupted as the Dreadfire's deck suddenly heaved beneath his feet, coming close to pitching him flat on his face. Heilmor grabbed a beam to steady himself, holding on as the deck lurched again. Cutlery and plates cascaded from the galley table as the ship seemed to revolve, swaying as if borne up by a heavy sea. "But the weather's calm," Heilmor thought, peering through the nearest porthole.
"Blows again, skipper?"
Scrimshine asked, eyes white and bright in his cadaverous face.
"Not with Jack so close by," Clay said,
making an unsteady progress to Heilmore's side with Chris following close behind.
"Reckon we got some fresh trouble, Captain."
The ship settled and Heilmor rushed for the steps to the upper deck, emerging to see Steelfine and a pair of crewmen leaning over the rail to stare at the water below. Moving to the islander's side, Heilmor followed his gaze to see that the sea was churning, large bubbles rising to the surface and bursting all around.
"Sea as balls! What a stink!"
one of the crew exclaimed, wafting the air from his nose at the miasma rising from the roiling sea.
It was a potent stench, to be sure, sulphurous and thick enough to clog the nostrils with an acrid sting. The fault in the sea floor, Aylmore realized as more bubbles rose, once again causing the dreadfire to sway. It must still be coughing out a great deal of lava, an annoyance but hardly an obstacle. Mr. Scrimshine, he called to the former smuggler. Take over the helm, if you please. Keep her heading north.
Aye, skipper.
Scrimshine gave one of his less-than-regulation salutes and ran to the tiller, pushing the previous helmsman aside with an urgent shove.
Stop!
Aylmore turned as a hand tugged at his sleeve, finding himself confronted by Kriz.
We need to stop,
she said in her clipped, street-level Mandalorian.
You may have noticed, miss, but time is against us.
Aylmore politely disentangled himself. Our food stocks being what they are.
Gas!
She interrupted, pointing towards the ship's prow. Aylmore followed her finger, frowning at the haze ahead. It was thin but definitely there, a soft grey vapour drifting amongst the bergs. Kriz said something in her own language, raising her finger to point at the distant fiery bulk of Mount Rainer. When Aylmore blinked at her in incomprehension, she gave what he assumed was a highly simplified translation.
Poison gas. The fault extends all the way to that volcano. If we sail towards it, everyone on board will be dead within the hour.
Aylmore went to the prow, training his spyglass on Raynor's slopes. The eruption that had begun days ago continued unabated. Huge chunks of molten rock spouted from the mountain's gaping summit in a plentiful torrent. The lava stream made a sluggish but irresistible progress to the sea, where great billows of steam occluded what he assumed to be a rapidly growing new island. Although his education in geology had been confined to a few classes at the Protectorate Maritime Academy, he knew another side effect of so much of the Earth's innards being released into the sea would be the production of various gases, none of which were conducive to longevity.
Trim sails!
Aylmore ordered, sending the sailors scurrying.
Mr. Steelfine, see if you can get the anchor lowered. Boiling some oil to melt the ice on the chains might do it.
I'll see to it, sir.
We can't wait this out,
Kriz said, moving closer to Aylmore and speaking in a low voice.
The eruption could go on for days. As you said, we don't have the food.
There is but one navigable channel through this ice, Aylmore said, pointing to the winding course ahead. He felt a resurgence of his earlier anger. The sensation of having no good options was never a comfortable one for a captain.
We sail on, we die. We stay, we die,
he thought, biting down on a sigh of frustration.
There is a way, Kriz said. But I'll need a particular substance in as much quantity as you can provide.
What substance? Kriz gave a doubtful frown, as if unsure the word she was about to speak was the right one.
Piss, she said with a bland smile. I need a great deal of piss.
Scrimshine proved the most productive of the crewmen, filling two large pickle jars to Hylemore's one.
Reckon I can squeeze out a few drops more, skipper,
he offered, breeches still undone as he hovered splay-footed over a steaming jar. Aylmore wasn't sure what smelled worse, the gas or the product of Scrimshine's bladder.
I think that'll do for now, he said,
averting his eyes as the helmsman buttoned himself up. There were some sights even a seasoned sailor couldn't abide. In addition to the urine, Kriz had Steelfine roast as much coal as could be crammed into the galley stove. The scorched bricks were then pounded into a fine powder.
Two layers will provide better protection, she explained,
laying out a strip of their thinnest fabric on the table. In addition to the Dreadfire's meager sails, the hold had yielded a number of flags, all dating back to the pre-corporate age. Aylmore assumed they were souvenirs of the long-dead Captain Bledthorn's brief pirating career. He had thought they might be worth something to an antiquities dealer, should they ever return to civilization, but was happy to surrender any potential profit in the circumstances. Under Chris's instructions, the flags had all been sliced into strips 6 inches wide and 12 long.
"Carbon absorbs most gases," she said,
spooning about a quarter pound of the powdered coal onto the fabric.
"But not all. Hopefully,"
she continued, laying another strip on top of the layer of coal dust, this one having been dipped into one of the steaming buckets.
"Urine will filter out the rest. Stitch them together and you have a basic respirator."
"Hopefully?" Eilmore asked, receiving a helpless shrug in response. He resisted the urge to ask more questions. There were no other choices, and this had to be risked.
"Let's be about it, lads," he said instead, sending the crew into motion. "Two masks each, just like she showed you. Stitch them tight and be quick."
He drew Chris aside as the crew got to work, speaking softly. "How long will they last?"
"It depends on the thickness of the gas. If we run into a dense concentration, they'll become saturated fairly quickly."
"At our current speed, it will take at least a day to reach the mountain and another to get clear of it."
"Then we need to sail faster."
"We've barely enough sheets to keep her moving as it is."
"Pardon me, Captain," Clay said, appearing at Chris's side. "But we don't need the wind to get this old tub moving. Just a lot of strong rope."
They used the Dreadfire's only boat to string the rope out in front of the prow. Eilmore, Steelfine, Clay, and the Elder Torcreek took on the task, the crew displaying a marked reluctance to place themselves in proximity to the monster, whose spines were frequently glimpsed cutting through the surrounding waters. Eilmore knew the sailors were unlikely to disobey a direct order, but thought it best not to fray their already thread-like nerves further. Steelfine, of course, appeared to have no nerves, whilst Braddon assumed a mantle of steady surety, though Eilmore caught the wariness in his gaze whenever it alighted on Jack's spines. By contrast, Clay exuded only a cheerful calm as they rowed away from the ship's hull, playing the rope out behind. It was really three ropes in one, the thickest hawsers they could find, braided into a single cable thicker than a man's arm. It had been fashioned into a loop some 30 yards long, both ends fixed to the anchor mountings on either side of the rotted figurehead on the Dreadfire's prow.
"Reckon this is far enough,"
Clay said, and the boat slowed to a gentle drift as Steelfine shipped oars.
"What now?"
Eilmore inquired, as Clay focused his gaze on Jack. The blue loitered only a stone's throw away, one great eye poking above the surface to regard them, either with curiosity or hunger. Eilmore couldn't tell. Clay's response was soft and cryptic, his expression now one of studied concentration as he stared at Jack.
"Now I get to see if I could have made Miss Ethelyn proud," he murmured.
For a full minute, nothing happened, Eilmore and the others looking at Clay in frigid expectation. The blood-blessed's brows creased and uncreased several times, his lips twitching all the while, and Eilmore knew he was witnessing direct communication between a human and a drake. Finally, the great eye blinked and disappeared below the surface, the beast's tall spines frothing the water as it twisted its body and dived.
"Let it go, Uncle,"
Clay told Braddon, and they released the rope in unison. It subsided below the surface with a soft splash that soon transformed into a white explosion as Jack's head erupted from the water barely a second later, huge jaws clamping down on the cable. The resultant swells sent their boat into a spin, Eilmore coming close to tipping over the side before Steelfine used his oars to steady the craft. Eilmore's gaze was drawn by the sound of Clay's laughter. He stood at the boat's stern, head shaking and grin wide as he regarded the sight of Jack, waiting patiently with the rope lodged firmly in his mouth.
"He gets it,"
Clay said and laughed again.
"He really gets it." 6 knots, do you think, Mr. Steelfine?
Closer to 7, sir.
The islander's voice was muffled by his mask, and he was obliged to shout to make himself understood.
Think he might get up to 8 when the channel straightens.